The Tom Woods Show, episode 488.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, if you've been meaning to start that blog or website, but you don't know what your first steps are, then check out the free ebook I created for you, taking you step by step through the process, including a free video tutorial showing you how to get a blog up and running in just 5 minutes. Plus, if you check out tomwoods.com/publicity before starting up that blog, I'll give you some free publicity right out of the gate. So check it all out, the free ebook, the video tutorial, and the publicity offer at tomwoods.com/publicity. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm on my way to Houston for Liberty Fest Houston this weekend, September 11th and 12th, 2015. So I expect to see you good Houstonians there. But of course, there is an episode for you anyway. And today we're going to talk about a field of economics some of you may be unfamiliar with. It's called welfare economics, and it has to do not with welfare payments, of course, but with making people better off. How can we be sure that people are made better off in some transaction? And we're going to see what Murray Rothbard had to say about that, and we're going to see what Brian Kaplan had to say about what Murray Rothbard had to say about that. Brian Kaplan is a guest of this show, who's been on in the past, but who wrote a famous article called Why I Am Not an Austrian Economist. And little by little, we've been working our way through that article. And on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/488, I will link you to, under the related episodes section, the two episodes we've done so far in which we've taken on some of what Kaplan has to say and tried to answer it from a traditional Austrian perspective. Joining me today to help us get a grip on this welfare economics subject, which is very important, by the way, as you'll see, this really is a key question. How can we know if people have been made better off? Of course, Rothbard, in his analysis, comes to the conclusion that we can never say that state action makes somebody better off. It is always going to make society worse off. And so we're going to look at that today with the help of our friend Jeff Herbener. Jeff has been a guest on this show numerous times. He is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College, which is an outstanding four-year school. It is always ranked as one of the top small liberal arts colleges. It has an entirely Austrian or Austrian sympathetic economics department, of which Jeff is the chairman. He is also associate editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and all around just an extremely smart guy. You can ask Jeff all the questions you want as part of your membership at libertyclassroom.com, where Jeff teaches our introductory course on Austrian economics, and he also teaches What's Wrong with Textbook Economics. This was my idea, by the way. I take full credit for this. He goes through one of the most commonly used textbooks in college in economics, and he goes through chapter by chapter and gives an Austrian critique. That's helpful for college students, but it's also helpful for anybody who just wants to know what's the difference between Austrian economics and the mainstream in area after area. So I strongly urge you to check that out at libertyclassroom.com. And let's turn things over now to Jeff Herbener. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
I just got done explaining to people that when we talk about welfare economics, we're not talking about the economics of welfare payments, although I can understand why an average person would think that. They don't know about this particular subfield of economics. And as a matter of fact, you gave a talk at the Mises University program on welfare economics. I'm sure you've done it more than once, but there was one year where you gave it, and when it went up, somebody who obviously hadn't bothered to listen. Can you believe people comment on videos without bothering to listen to them?
No, it's shocking.
It went on to say in the comments section that, of course, you know, you're a white man, so naturally we would expect you to have these views on welfare. And I thought, I don't think your views on Pareto have anything to do with whether right. You're a white man or not. The guy obviously thought we were talking about, aid to families with dependent children or food stamps or something. So anyway, that is not what we're talking about. But I mean, we are talking about something that involves trying to assess whether people's well-being has been improved. And so in that sense of the word welfare, the term is appropriate. I'd like to start off by having you explain two things. First, I want you to talk about the test of Pareto optimality or Pareto superior movements, and then secondly, talk about Murray Rothbard's approach to welfare economics and how that was a challenge to the way other economists had been thinking about the subject.
Okay, sure. So to start with Pareto, it was developed, Pareto again was part of the neoclassical economics movement in the early part of the 20th century, and so this became a mainstream approach to the question of what we might call social welfare. That is to say, can we logically conceive of all of the different social interactions that people might engage in that would demonstrably make people better off in society? And so Pareto said, sure, we can think of certain types of social interaction that would do that. For example, a voluntary exchange. So Pareto said, in a voluntary exchange, both the trading partners benefit according to their own subjective judgment of the value of what they obtain compared to the value of what they give up. So each person in a voluntary exchange gives up what they value less and acquires what they value more. And so Pareto said, in that instance, we could say when two people make a voluntary exchange that both of them benefit, and it doesn't appear that anybody else through that action is made worse off, that their welfare is diminished. So you could imagine exchanges with three people involved or four or whatever. So everybody else in society is not engaged in that action, so their welfare is staying the same, and the welfare of everyone participating in the voluntary exchange is improving. And so Pareto said that sort of activity, a voluntary exchange, would be what he called Pareto superior, or what came to be called Pareto superior. So this move increases the welfare of people in society overall, and the condition under which Pareto insisted that this would be so would be that in the all the participants in this interaction, no one can be harmed. So if somebody's welfare goes down in a social interaction, which wouldn't be the case with a voluntary exchange, but let's say it would be the case with maybe the government is taxing one group and then transferring the funds to another group, that the well-being or the value that accrues to the goods that the tax group has is diminished. Pareto then said, in cases like that, he called this Pareto inferior. Some persons are harmed, their welfare goes down, and other persons, their welfare are benefited, their welfare improves. And Pareto said, in that case, we can't say that social welfare has improved because we can't make interpersonal welfare comparisons. So that's the basic idea.
So in other words, you have no basis for comparing there's no number that can say this group's welfare went up by X, but the other group's welfare went down by X plus 7, so therefore it's a net minus. There's no way to make that. I just want people to understand what you mean when you say you can't make interpersonal welfare comparisons.
Yeah, that's correct. And this was a big innovation of the modern economics, from the marginalist revolution. This was a conclusion that that was accepted by economists and then being debated in this time of Pareto. And Pareto accepted the conclusion that neoclassical economists came to, which was that the subjectivity of value, the fact that we have the value of our actions in our mind, does not permit us to have meaningful numeric analysis of utility. But if we don't have a unit of utility, then we can't do comparisons between people. So we could measure the difference in height between people because we have an external unit of height, the foot or whatever, to measure their height. But we can't measure people's subjective values because we can't come up with a common unit of value. And so in all cases where one person or group of people, their utility goes down, and another group, their utility goes up from some kind of participation in a social interaction, then Pareto said that's Pareto inferior. A situation like that could never move us to towards the situation where we've exhausted all possible Pareto-Superior interactions. If we could imagine a state of affairs like that, which is purely hypothetical, Pareto said we'd call that Pareto optimality. So Pareto optimality is a situation where all of the Pareto-Superior social interactions are taken in society, and none of the Pareto-Inferior social interactions are taken.
All right. How does Rothbard differ from this? Because some of this does sound a little bit like what Rothbard says in his – he had a book chapter that became very influential in Austrian circles in 1956 toward a reconstruction of utility and welfare economics. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/488. That really is the definitive statement of Rothbardian welfare economics.
Right. So what happened after Pareto, we have to pick up the story, sort of the development of welfare economics. What happened after Pareto was some other economists came along and tried to circumvent this restriction that Pareto had put upon social interactions, because it seems quite apparent that if we adopt this Pareto rule, that no action of the government whatsoever could be considered Pareto superior, because there are always
right.
persons
so,
are harmed. And
exactly. There's yeah. always – right. And so therefore, instead of saying – I better modify my policy preferences. We have to change the rule.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The kids aren't doing well on the SAT. Let's change the scoring. Like, we never make any fundamental changes.
Yeah. So economists are, succumb to this same problem as people in general. But anyway, so Pareto, so people tried to get around the Pareto, other economists tried to get around this restriction, but they can't bear to give up this. This principle that no interpersonal comparisons of utility can be made. So they come up with this notion of the social welfare function, where they say that, okay, one thing that the government could do is redistribute income of everyone, and then with the redistributed income, we just let the market play out, and we'll get the Pareto optimal solution. But we could imagine getting different Pareto optimal solutions depending on the income distribution in society. So governments are justified, they argued, in redistributing income. That would not interfere with the achievement of the Pareto optimal state. And so where Murray comes in this debate, he says, no, wait a minute. Actually, that reasoning seems to beg the question, because there's a the outcome, the distribution of income, so to speak, is an outcome of the market process. And so if the government redistributes income, they are engaged in Pareto inferior moves, because they're taxing one group and giving the funds to another. So that doesn't seem to work. And it was really recognized by the neoclassical economists working in welfare theory that they were reaching a dead end. And Murray stepped in and he said, but we could, if the neoclassical economist is serious about welfare economics, we could reconstitute it. But we would have to reconstitute it along the lines of a genuine starting point in private property. And so we would have to say that each person owns his own labor. That's a starting point of property ownership. And then homesteads goods out of nature. And that would be a Pareto superior move. And then produces things, maybe in voluntary cooperation with other people, which would also be a Pareto superior move. And then they exchange those things and so on. And so you can work through a kind of Pareto dynamic that would result in the justification, once again, as the original Pareto analysis did, of all market activity, of all voluntary activity in the market, and yet not justify any state activity whatsoever. I should say, just for clarity, that this this analysis was drawn out of Murray's work by Hans Hoppe.
Yeah, you know what? I should link to Hans also on welfare economics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to do that too. So the concept of demonstrated preference is really central to what Rothbard is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about what's hidden in people's minds, and we're not, and it is nothing like that. It's just, if I, in the market, engage in a transaction, that is my way of telling you. In a way, it's like actions speak louder than words.
Right.
That in taking the action, you can tell that I've improved my condition as compared to what it would have been if I hadn't taken the action. Or otherwise, why would I do it? Now, if just so that we can anticipate, he takes into account the possibility that you could later regret your action or you could act in error. But he's talking about at that particular moment, you're doing what you believe to be something that improves your welfare. And this demonstrates to a neutral observer that you're improving your welfare.
Right. So here, I think there is an important addendum to make to Murray's work here. Some people, and we'll get to this when we talk about Kaplan, but some people seem to think that the Pareto analysis, as developed by Pareto himself, took no account of this distinction between welfare or utility or value that people acquire who are participating in an action and the states of minds of bystanders with respect to that action. But actually, the whole Pareto analysis depends upon this distinction. What Murray's doing is simply making this explicit. He's simply drawing out this sort of hidden assumption in the Pareto analysis that existed already. So what he's saying again is that there is no way that we as economists, as objective analysts of society, can say anything objectively about people's welfare unless it's a logical implication of the way in which they're choosing and acting. And so third-party bystanders, we simply, whatever their state of mind is with respect to the activity of other people, we can't know anything scientifically or objectively about those states of mind, and therefore we can't include their states of mind in an objective scientific analysis. So
So that handles an objection that I've heard, which would be, suppose I sell my company to you for $100 million. You pay me the money, I give you the company. We're both better off. Rothbard would say that clearly both of our utility has been increased, even if there's no unit for it. But the objection has been, one of the objections, what if there are people in our society who are envious? And even though they are not directly harmed by my sale of my company, they just can't believe I earned $100 million for selling a company. And they are just so fuming with envy that Rothbard would have to say that the effect on social welfare is indeterminate, because there's no way that I can have a unit to measure how much worse off they are because their envy has been stoked at my good fortune as compared to the realization of my good fortune and the increase in welfare that I get from that.
Right. And again, just to reiterate it, no economists have taken in welfare economics have taken the position that somehow we can scientifically include envious people or third-party bystanders in welfare analysis. To do scientific analysis, we can only include in the analysis what we can objectively ascertain about people's states of mind. And since they're subjective, we can only ascertain something about their states of mind objectively from inference that we make from the actions that they take. You might think of this as an analogy. Let's suppose we had a medical scientist who wanted to do a scientific study of the effect of smoking on the body. And so he would set up a control and a test group of people and observe them over the decades and their behavior, where one group similar in behavior to another, but one group smokes and the other doesn't, and he would get all this data. And he would use that data in his analysis, but he might know of all sorts of anecdotal instances of people who smoke, without any effect, or people who just smoke a little bit and get terrible cancer. You know, his brother-in-law maybe smoked all his life until he was 90 and never got cancer, but he can't include that in his scientific study. It's not scientifically ascertained data, and so it just doesn't count, right? And in a similar fashion, envy, just we can't count it. We don't know how to incorporate it into an objective scientific analysis.
Well, let's turn now to the Brian Kaplan analysis of this. And it's not that long. It's only – there are just five paragraphs in his essay on why he's not an Austrian economist. I'm just going to read the first two paragraphs verbatim, and then we can – because the first two paragraphs have one self-contained argument – So he says, while he's continuing from a previous section, while Rothbard and Mises had similar objections to mainstream utility theory, Rothbard went one step further by reconstructing welfare economics along Austrian lines. His main conclusions are simple and austere. Every market transaction benefits all participants, while every act of government intervention benefits some people at the expense of others. Rothbard goes on to make a seemingly stronger claim. If we allow ourselves to use the term society to depict the pattern of all individual exchanges, then we may say that the free market maximizes social utility since everyone gains in utility. So that sentence was a quotation from Rothbard. He says, this claim might be rephrased to say simply that each voluntary exchange benefits all participants, and the free market permits the implementation of all desired voluntary exchanges. That's the first paragraph. Then he says, Hans Hermann Hoppe, arguing for Rothbard's approach, makes a subtly stronger claim, and here he quotes Hans. Pareto optimality is not only compatible with methodological individualism, together with the notion of demonstrated preference, it also provides the key to Austrian welfare economics, and it's proof that the free market, operating according to the rules just described, always and invariably so increases social utility, while each deviation from it decreases it, unquote. And now back to Kaplan. Strictly speaking, however, Rothbard could only claim the welfare effects of government intervention upon social utility are indeterminate, i.e., since the victim loses and the intervener gains, it is impossible to say anything about social utility without making a verboten interpersonal welfare comparison. This is an important point because it shows that Rothbard's welfare economics provides a much weaker defense of the free market than usually assumed. In particular, Rothbard's own theory strips him of the ability to call any act of government inefficient. By denying the ability to endorse state action in the name of efficiency, Rothbard also implicitly denies the ability to reject state action in the name of efficiency. This is no logical flaw in Rothbard's theory, although it does reveal a logical flaw in Hoppe's presentation of Rothbard's theory, but its political implications are rather different than commonly assumed. Rothbard's welfare criterion justifies agnosticism about, not denial of, the benefits of statism. So let me state this succinctly. What he's saying is we take Rothbard to be giving a ringing defense of the free market because he says that because of demonstrated preference, we can clearly see that a voluntary, uncoerced interaction improves people's utility and by extension social utility, if we want to use that term. But in fact, when we're dealing and then when we're dealing with a government interaction where the government takes my money and gives it to somebody else, all right, well, we've got clearly I'm made worse off by the government taking my money, so we can say that things have been made worse. But Kaplan would say we can't say that because maybe the person who got the money is made so much better off than you are made worse off. Maybe it's an improvement. There's no way to know. So instead of saying it's a definite decrease in social utility, we have to say it's indeterminate. We can't tell one way or the other because we can't measure how much worse off you are as versus how much better off the other person is. What's the problem with that objection?
Okay, well, let me say something about the kind of a general point first before we deal with the specifics of that claim. I think what is generally wrong about Kaplan's assessment here is that he's misinterpreting the point of Rothbard's article on welfare economics. The point of this article was not to provide a defense of the free market. It's well known that Rothbard's defense of the free market is not utilitarian. It's not based on maximizing social welfare. Rothbard was not a utilitarian. His defense of the market was based on natural law and natural rights, as is laid out in the Ethics of Liberty. And so what Rothbard is doing in this article is not saying, here is my number one defense of the free market, argument in favor of the free market. He's saying, if neoclassical economists are serious about doing welfare economics, then they must accept the free market as providing the greatest social welfare. Their own theory leads them to this conclusion if they reconstruct this theory on proper grounds. He's just taking Pareto's original analysis, and he's bolstering the logical underpinnings of it, saying, look, this is what you guys must conclude from your own analytical apparatus. So I think this whole discussion of Kaplan is misdirected. This is not, Rothbard isn't using this as an argument in favor of the free market, but simply as a trying to get neoclassical economists to recognize the implications of their own analysis. And if they wish to accept this notion, continue to accept this notion of Pareto optimality and general equilibrium, then they should be in favor of the free market like Rothbard is too. Even their analysis would demonstrate the efficacy of the free market. Now, on this narrow point, what Rothbard says again in conclusion to or as a conclusion to this the state of affairs about what can be said about social utility is, again, exactly the same thing that Pareto and the other neoclassical economists say about social utility. This conclusion really is no different. They both say that all voluntary interactions unambiguously improve social utility and therefore movements toward Pareto optimality, and all state interactions that harm some or lower the utility of some and raise the utility of others are Pareto inferior and do not move us toward Pareto optimality, and that's the end of that. It is true that one could maybe go too far. One could draw conclusions out of this case of the state action harming some and benefiting others that aren't warranted. But I don't think Rothbard does this. I think that this he's just reiterating the same conclusions that neoclassical economists come to.
All right, well then let me read to you the other primary objection that Kaplan has. He says, there is, however, a more serious flaw in Rothbard's welfare economics, a flaw which again flows from his behaviorist insistence that only preferences demonstrated in action are real. Thus, Rothbard rejects the argument that the envy of a third party vitiates the principle that voluntary exchange increases social utility. All right, that's the objection that I raised a little while ago. And he quotes Rothbard. We cannot, however, deal with hypothetical utilities divorced from concrete action. We may, as praxeologists, deal only with utilities that we can deduce from the concrete behavior of human beings. A person's envy, unembodied in action, becomes pure moonshine from a praxeological point of view. How he feels about the exchanges made by others cannot be demonstrated unless he commits an invasive act. Even if he publishes a pamphlet denouncing these exchanges, we have no ironclad proof that this is not a joke or a deliberate lie, unquote. Now again, Kaplan. Indeed, Rothbard could have taken this principle further. When two people sign a contract, do they actually demonstrate their preference for the terms of the contract? Perhaps they merely demonstrate their preference for signing their name on the piece of paper in front of them. There is no, quote, ironclad proof, unquote, that the signing of one's name on a piece of paper is not a joke or even an effort to improve one's penmanship. And then second paragraph of this part of the critique, Rothbard's refusal to acknowledge unobserved preferences would have to impress even B.F. Skinner. What possible reason could we have to believe that utility is moonshine unless expressed in concrete actions? At every moment, by introspection, we are aware of preferences unrevealed by our behavior. Figuring out the mental states of other people is obviously more difficult, but that hardly shows that their mental states do not exist. The statist could easily reverse Rothbard's objection and claim that since there is no ironclad proof that third parties do not object to other people's voluntary exchanges, it is impossible to say whether they increase social utility. Thus, Rothbard's welfare economics terminates in agnosticism about not only the benefits of intervention, but the benefits of voluntary exchange. All right, there's a lot packed into there. How do you want to attack it?
Yeah, right. Let's start with the easiest part first on the signing of the contract as a extension of this attempt at a reductio ad absurdum on Rothbard. But I don't think Rothbard would say anything about the states of utility in the minds of people signing the contract. That's not the action that he's referring to. The social interaction he's referring to is not the signing the contract, but the actual exchange of the property. So it doesn't really matter what their states of mind are in the signing of a contract.
Oh, that's good.
What's important,
okay.
What's important in the voluntary exchange is the actual trade of the property ownership. And so that's analogous, right, to somebody writing a pamphlet and saying, I'm envious. I think he misfired. I think Kaplan misfires here. On the other, you know, the main other point about all of this is that if one is to accept third-party envy as relevant for doing welfare economics, then it's not Rothbard's system of welfare economics, at least not alone, that crashes to the ground. It's all welfare economics. Of course, you can't do any welfare economics if you include unobservable, if you just make guesses about what people's unobservable hypothetical states of mind are as they react to other people engaged in real behavior. If Pareto had that notion in his mind when he first formulated his rule, then of course he would have nothing to say whatsoever. Who would? All we could say is that every social interaction is indeterminate in that sense. What we need is some way of discerning or distinguishing between objectively demonstrable of welfare states, where we can, researchers, as scientists, we can infer something objectively is true about welfare in the minds of people, and distinguish those states of affairs from instances where we can't say anything objectively about people's states of mind.
Jeff, let's take just a minute for this message. Hey, all you good listeners, there are many reasons you might want to start up a blog or website. Maybe just a labor of love, or you want to join the conversation, or you want to show off your work and your portfolio to potential clients and employers. You could start a blog talking about all the great innovations going on at your company and have pictures of the company picnic up there and what so-and-so is up to at the company. That'll get you noticed. You won't be the first fired after that. Or a site about all the developments going on in your industry. That'll get you noticed by potential employers around the industry. So a lot of different ways you can do this, but you definitely want to do it. And because I'm one of a very small number of people who are VIP affiliates of Bluehost, I can get you the lowest rate they have on web hosting. And if you don't know what hosting is, you can find out about that in my free ebook. Get all of this stuff, the ebook, my video tutorial on this, and my publicity offer to get your blog off the ground at tomwoods.com/publicity. Jeff, let's just look at one line here in the Kaplan critique that I read. He says there's a more serious flaw in Rothbard's welfare economics that it flows from his insistence that only preferences demonstrated in action are real. Well, I don't think he's saying that they're not real. I think the question is, are they the potential subject of scientific investigation?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so Rothbard never denied that subjective states of mind are real. Of course, they're real. I mean, he even has cases that he goes through this analysis in some of his writings about how there are envious people. We could admit this, but the point to reiterate is to, as you said, to make a distinction between scientifically observable data that we can infer from observation about people's states of minds, and then states of minds that we can't, as scientists, have any objective knowledge about.
Jeff, you have written on this, but have you written on Rothbard's welfare economics because other people were criticizing it, or have you written something just spontaneously of your own accord?
No. What I've written has been in response to critical work.
Do you think you'd be able to? I know I've read your stuff. I know there was an article, I think, written by two people that you responded to, if I recall that right, and it was some years ago. Is that something that's immediately at hand that you could send me? I could put it on tomwoods.com/488.
Oh,
yeah, that's right. I'm making you do the work.
Yeah,
I bet if we
yeah.
dug through, it's in the QJ, wouldn't it be?
No, it's not in the QJ. It's in a European journal.
All right.
So I don't know if I can get online access to it. I could send you a file.
Okay, one way or another, we'll get it up.
Yeah, okay,
you tell me what the once we get off the line here, I'll get the title of the piece from you.
Okay.
I'll Google around for it first.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well, look, this is great. I mean, this is actually a really technical topic, but I bet at least half the listeners don't even realize that because of how well you expressed it, and that I think that's a combination. 80% of you're a very good explainer, and 20% I put the fear of God into you at the beginning of this episode that no one's going to understand what we're saying. I'm afraid, right? We have to be really careful to explain this because it's an important field of economics,
right.
And it.
Right.
Now, by the way, I mean, since I'm not a professional economist and I don't deal with textbooks and so on. What is the state of welfare economics today? Do economists have this field that they refer to as welfare economics? Is it just part of the warp and woof of economics so that it's not really studied distinctly?
Yeah, I would say the latter. It's still a part of what economists study, at least as the historical development of economic thought. It's sort of in the toolkit of economists, but I wouldn't say it's an active area of research, really.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering about that because I don't hear it talked about really anymore. And by the way, this is great. I'm going to put this on the calendar. Let's see. What's it? This is running on September 11th, 2015. First time in my life I've ever gotten to use the expression warp and woof. That's awesome. All right, Jeff, thanks for your time. We'll try and get that article up there by hook or by crook. First time I've ever used that expression. We've got to end this conversation. Who knows what I'll say next? Thanks so much. It's great talking to you.
You too, Tom. Thanks.
All right, everybody. Remember, September 16th, 2015, I'll be in Granby, Colorado. Then October 3rd in Dallas and December 3rd in New York City. All the details at tomwoods.com/events. If you're a listener of this show, you can get into the Dallas event, which normally costs $95. It's a Mises Circle event, complete with lunch. You get in for free. You get in for free by writing to me at tomwoods.com. Click on the contact page at the top of the screen and just fill out the form, and you can attend for free. You'll be getting a confirmation through email, and I'm going to be finalizing this with the Mises Institute, but it looks like another perk for my supporting listeners will be free admission to all Mises Institute events featuring me, probably excluding the Mises University event because that's got to be kept for students so they can get the most out of that. And discounts on all other Mises Institute events. But right now, whether or not you are a member of the Supporting Listeners Program, which is a program that supports the show in exchange for many goodies, such as this one, supportinglisteners.com, whether or not you're a member of that program, you get into the Dallas event for free if you just write to me at tomwoods.com. A couple other things. This weekend, we are opening up course number 14. At libertyclassroom.com. It's a U.S. history course taught by Brad Berzer, who's been on this show. So we've now got 14 courses. The price is still the same as when we had four courses. We just keep adding stuff, and you just get it as part of your membership. So check that out at libertyclassroom.com. And finally, we've had an influx of new listeners recently. So I want to let you folks know, I had a new book last year. I didn't have time to promote it. But I had a new book. It actually did pretty well. It was the first time I've ever really self-published a book. And it's called Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. And if you enjoy this show, you'll really like that book. It will help you win arguments. It's got a lot of my stuff where I take on critics of libertarianism and I just let them have it as politely as possible, but that's not always possible. So find out about that book at realdissent.com. You'll find that the Kindle edition, I mean, this is over a 300-page book. Kindle edition is only $3.99, which I think is fair. And the audiobook version, which has me reading it, can be acquired for free through tomwoodsaudio.com. All right, that's it for this week, everybody. Enjoy your weekend, and more Tom Woods Show episodes coming next week. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.